The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week, after the Sunday morning talk, someone who was here told me, as preparation for a question, he said that he grew up, his father was a Christian minister. He grew up and he went to seminary. And he was always taught to turn the other cheek. And his mother told him that he'd never learned to defend himself. And then he said, what does Buddhism think? Christianity says turn the other cheek. What does Buddhism say? So that was an interesting question. And I don't know much about Christianity, and I don't know, I guess that expression, turn the other cheek, appears a few times in the Gospels, and appears, I think, in the Sermon on the Mount. Is that right? Turn the other cheek. If someone strikes you, you turn the other cheek. If, I think it also says something like, if someone steals your cloak, then give them your shirt. Is that right? Something like that. And I also think that in Christianity, that expression, turn the other cheek, has been interpreted different ways by different people. So it's not just one way of understanding it. But at least on the surface, it looks like if someone hits you, hits you on the cheek, that you offer them the other one. And it can be quite a powerful thing to do. Certainly it's powerful not to retaliate and not to come from anger or violence yourself, but to stand there and be willing to receive it. And sometimes it's a very powerful technique, strategy, to do that. Sometimes it can turn the attacker's heart dramatically around. I was once, when I was 21... A friend of mine, I had wronged him in a way that deserved what was coming. But he stormed across this field to me, and I knew what was coming. But he came to fight, and so I dropped to one knee. And he stormed up to me and said, with his fists up, and said, let's fight. And I opened my hands to my side, my palms towards him, and I said, I can't. You know, I'm on my knees, right? Pretty defenseless position. So it's not exactly the same as turning the cheek, but it's like, you know, I'm not going to fight. I'm here. You know, I'm lowering myself here, available. You need to do something. And so he pivoted around and left in disgust. So, but anyway, I was uninjured. And so, you know, sometimes it's, it can be a useful strategy to get out of trouble. And I don't think it helped him any for me to do that. Maybe it helped him. Maybe it saved him from the problems that he would have if he had hurt me. So I was asked last week, what about this, what does Buddhism say about this? And on the surface, Buddhism would seem to say something similar. Some people hear Buddhist teachings as if you're supposed to be very self-effacing, as if you're not supposed to ever act from anger or from violence. And in a sense, sometimes they even hear it further, that you're supposed to, Buddhist practice is about being very, very accepting of what is. Just be present, be accepting how things are, and so if things are terrible, just sit there, and you have no, the not-self-teaching, it means that you don't really count for anything. You're not important for anything. You're supposed to just let go of your conceit, and so you don't really count, so you just kind of just sit there and not defend yourself, not do anything. And so something like that sometimes is a kind of misunderstanding of Buddhism. Some people who value being invisible, value some idea of that they don't really count, sometimes like Buddhist teachings because, oh, that not self thing, yeah, that's good. You know, I'm unimportant. But so he asked me last week, you know, what is Buddhism meant to say? And so I said that what Buddhism teaches is if someone strikes you, you know, on the cheek, on the right cheek, then you look them right in the eye. You don't turn the other cheek. You don't offer your other cheek. But you also don't strike them back, necessarily. You also don't turn away, but you hold your ground and you look at them. And the idea of looking a person in the eye, something very deep happens when people look each other in the eyes, or they can happen. And so the idea of kind of really connecting to, sometimes as I said, you know, you connect someone's soul through their eyes, but you really look, and they look into your eyes, and then you engage them in some way, if they can. And so it's not the Buddhist way to turn away. But it's also not the Buddhist way to attack. But I think it's the Buddhist way to take a stand. But it's a stand that is not tense. It's a stand which is not aggressive. But it's not a stand where you're a pushover. So if someone says, I need to get through you, I need to get by you somehow, and it's inappropriate for them to get by you, so you don't have to hit them, but you don't have to move out of the way either. They have to contend with the fact that you're standing there. And that contention then is where there's a dialogue or a relationship that goes on. So in my first Zen teacher, he said that Buddha's contribution to humanity, it was a very simple caricature, but the Buddha's contribution to humanity was the importance of meditating. Gandhi's contribution was that it was important where you meditated. And so we had in the early 1980s people who would meditate on the train tracks to the place over there. Was it where?
Port Chicago.
Port Chicago, over there in the East Bay, where they would have these munitions and research things kind of being. And I think going into Livermore Lab. And so, you know, it's one thing to meditate in the privacy of your own bedroom. It's another thing to meditate someplace where the, you know, you're saying, you know, this is not acceptable. So Gandhi's contribution is where you take a stand is important. Where you count is important. So this points back to, I think, for Buddhists, to the idea of, you know, what is the inherent dignity and value of a human being? So, and what is yours? And what do you have a right to do, or what's appropriate for you? And again, maybe it's a dangerous caricature, but to compare, which I've done recently a few times now, Indian culture as a whole, or Buddhism in particular, and then kind of Western culture as a whole, which is kind of dangerous. But Western culture comes out of this very strong Judeo-Christian ethic, Judeo-Christian philosophy. And there's a number of elements of this Judeo-Christian kind of background which has conditioned or entered into the popular culture in such a way that people who are don't consider themselves Jewish or Christian and are maybe atheists still carry some of the mindset that comes out of that background. And one of them is the idea that there is some external authority or power that has tremendous role in your life. There's someone who has arbitrated certain rules, the commandments, and those commandments come from an external source. Ethics comes from an external source that you measure yourself against. And there's someone out there who is going to have a very big, it's going to make some really big decisions about what's going to happen for you for the rest of the eternity. And so what this judge is going to say about you is really big. So people who don't necessarily believe in that kind of idea anymore, sometimes kind of remnants of that exist where there's a tendency among many Westerners, people acculturated here, to look towards ethics as being something external, and to look for approval externally, to find out if we're right and we're wrong. And then you add to that the Western individualism, such a strong, it's hard to, for people who are really kind of only grew up in the West, in America, from, you know, kind of popular culture here, it's hard for them to understand how deeply ingrained Western individualism is, and how strong a cultural conditioning is that goes into it. And with that comes values of wanting to be unique. And as we want to be unique, then it leads to alienation, or it leads to overdependence. It leads to looking for some kind of, even though we're trying to be unique in ourselves, there's some way in being ourselves in a society, in a cultural background where authority is seen outside, ethics is seen outside of oneself. It lends towards towards either kind of succumbing, looking for approval externally, or wanting to be the authority oneself. So in India, they don't have a theistic foundation for the cultural thinking. They have a karmic one. And karma doesn't begin with something external. Karma begins with you, especially for Buddhism. Karma has to be... So in Christianity, the Bible begins with, in the beginning there was God. The Buddhist Bible, in a sense, begins, in the beginning there was the mind, your mind. And the mind is a forerunner of all things. And so ethics in a karma culture or in Buddhism is not looking externally for a validation and for authority, but rather is looking from, starting from the inside and trying to understand what is beneficial and what's harmful and what's beneficial. What are the things that I can do that can create bad consequences for me? What are the things I can do that create good consequences for me? And so the focus is on, then it has a very different relationship to ethics. So the tendency in Buddhist cultures is not to look at ethics as this absolute thing, this absolute kind of puritanical kind of idea that this is going to define who I am, my right and wrong actions, but rather to look inside, what can I do? How can I respond? My response is important. So what is the response? And with a focus on the mind being the beginning rather than God, I would argue that Buddhism puts a tremendous value on a human life, on each individual person, their own conscience, their own ability to choose for themselves, and their own value. And so Buddhism is not about being self-effacing or being kind of meek by any kind of means. The language of the early Buddha is language of strength. The word for making effort, virya, comes from the word hero. So heroic effort, heroic energy. As we develop mindfulness, the mindfulness is supposed to be developed to a point where it becomes a power. And there's a variety of powers, capacities, capabilities we have that are meant to become powers within us. So the power of mindfulness, the power of virya, this effort, the power of wisdom, the power of a concentrated mind. Rather than emphasizing being kind of relaxed to the point of being weak, the emphasis in Buddhism is to be relaxed to the point of being powerful. And so the statue of the Buddha is a statue of someone who's has certain kind of inner power and dignity, sitting upright, strong, very present. And so so what happens when someone wrongs you? When someone hits you in the hits you in the cheek, are you supposed to then kind of pretend that you don't count? The tendency for people who hold back too much, or think that don't count, or try to accept it, to be patient with it too much, is that sometimes it backfires because a tension builds up inside until finally the person gets to the breaking point and they lash out violently. I have to accept this, I have to go along with it. And I don't think just going along with things and being patient with things is necessarily the best strategy. Patience in Buddhism, because remember, the focus is on the mind in Buddhism more than external. Patience in Buddhism tends to focus much more on patience with yourself, patience with your own tendency to get angry, so that you don't succumb to your anger. But you don't not expected to be necessarily patient with the things outside. You're not supposed to be impatient either. But what happens if we come from a place of strength and take a stand? I'm here, and you're there, and I'm here to engage you. I'm here to be in dialogue with you. I'm safe. I'm not going to attack you. I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to get angry with you. But I'm also not going to be a pushover. I'm here. I count. And so all the emphasis in Buddhism and learning to let go is not to let go so you just kind of be okay with anything, but to let go of the inhibitions or the fears that get in the way of taking your stand. One of the things that prevents taking an effective stand is conceit, is too much of a sense of being individual and I count. You're much more effective taking a stand if we can take a stand without needing to puff up or needing to prove ourselves or needing to have an identity we're trying to defend. We can just be there, open, transparent, present, and engage the person we're with. It's very powerful to do this. And I believe this is kind of the foundation for the tremendous examples we've had in the last 100 years and further back as well of nonviolent resistance, nonviolent struggle that existed. And now we see it just most recently in Egypt. That was a phenomenal, 30 million people, right? Was that 60 million people? It's a huge country with a huge army. And if the people of Egypt had risen up violently against the government, they would have been squashed. But they rose up nonviolently for the most part. And it's quite something. It's brought down a dictator. They took their stand. And the fact that people showed up was what was the most important thing. They showed up at a particular square, center of Cairo, and they kept showing up. And there they stood, and they stood. You have to listen to us. Powerful thing. So I read, maybe some of you read the New Yorker article from last week about one of the sources of influence for the people in Egypt. And it was a man, American by the name of Gene Sharp, who in my youth was one of my heroes, because he wrote a book, a 3-volume book on the philosophy, I forget exactly what it's called, but the philosophy and strategy or philosophy and technique of nonviolent action. And he'd done his PhD on it. And was a professor of probably political science or something. And he had studied nonviolent movements down through the ages. And he said, there's no manual. Most people who successfully or unsuccessfully manage nonviolent resistance to something, a struggle, are just doing it intuitively. They pick up little ideas here and there. But there needs to be a manual. So he wrote a manual, a 3-volume manual, on how this is done, the history of it all. And he took, and then in the late early 80s, he wrote a 82-page concise manual about how to overcome, how to deal with dictators. And it was that 82-page treatise that was translated into Egyptian, Arabic, in the people in 2005 who were kind of trying to deal with the government there realized they had very little hope, and they were casting about for something, some ideas. And they saw that in Serbia there had been some successful movements of nonviolent action. And so they asked the Serbians, and they said, oh, Gene Sharp, they said. So then they translated Gene Sharp, and they got one of his kind of students to come and do some trainings in Egypt for them. And so that was there in the background. So it wasn't just completely spontaneous uprising. there was thought that went into it among some people. One of the remarkable examples of often brought up is Gandhi. And one of the amazing things about Gandhi, many amazing things, but within a couple of years of nonviolent resistance against the English, this guy, basically walked around India in just his diaper, just the cloth, he had so little, was treated as an equal by the rulers of the English Empire. He went to England and was met as head of state. He wasn't elected to any position of power, but he took a stand. One of the most powerful stands he took was he went to collect salt. He took a few things of salt in his hand, and they arrested him. So he took a stand. Powerful thing to take a stand. And Martin Luther King as well, and the whole civil rights movement, were people who consciously felt the worth of a human being and said that because we're worthy and valuable people, you cannot do these things to us. And we're going to stand here because we need to change you, because we can't accept this anymore. So this is what Martin Luther King said. It must be emphasized that nonviolent resistance is not a method for cowards. It does resist. If one uses this method because one is afraid or merely because one lacks the instruments of violence, one is not truly nonviolent. This is why Gandhi often said that if cowardice is the only alternative to violence, it is better to fight. He made this statement conscious of the fact that there is always another alternative. No individual or group need submit to any wrong, nor need they use violence to right the wrong. There is a way of nonviolent resistance. This ultimately is the way of the strong person. It is not a method of stagnant passivity. The phrase passive resistance often gives the false impression that this is a sort of do-nothing method, in which the resistor quietly and passively accepts evil. But nothing is further from the truth. For while the nonviolent resistor is passive in the sense that he is not physically aggressive towards his opponent, his mind and emotions are always active, constantly seeking to persuade his opponent that he is wrong. The message is passive physically, but strongly active spiritually. A second basic fact that characterizes nonviolence is that it does not seek to defeat or humiliate the opponent, but to win over his or her friendship and understanding. The nonviolent resistor must often express his or her protest through non-cooperation or boycotts, but he realizes that these are not ends to themselves. They are merely means to awaken a sense of moral shame in the opponent. The end is redemption and reconciliation. It's a speech that Martin Luther King gave in 1958. The fourth point that characterizes nonviolent resistance is a willingness to accept suffering without retaliation, to accept blows from the opponent without striking back. Rivers of blood may have to flow before we gain our freedom, but it must be our blood, Gandhi said to his countrymen. The nonviolent resistor is willing to accept violence if necessary, but never to inflict it. He does not seek to dodge jail. If going to jail is necessary, he enters it as a bridegroom enters a bride's chamber. One may well ask, what is a nonviolent resistor's justification for this ordeal to which he invites men, for this mass political application of the ancient doctrine of turning to the other cheek? The answer is found in the realization that unearned suffering is redemptive. Suffering, the nonviolent resistor realizes, has tremendous educational and transforming possibilities. Things of fundamental importance to people are not secured by reason alone, but have to be purchased with their suffering, said Gandhi. He continues, suffering is infinitely more powerful than the law of the jungle for converting the opponent and opening his ears, which are otherwise shut to the voice of reason. So it goes against so much intuition to be willing to accept this kind of suffering. But how many people died in Egypt in the last, in this uprising that happened there? Some 300 people or so? And that's a huge number of people to die. But how many people have died in Iraq? Maybe it's not fair to compare, but how many people usually die when there's a violent uprising that brings down a government? Are you one of the people who are willing to, you know, if people who are willing to fight to bring down a government are willing to die? But are you willing to do it in a nonviolent fight, where when you're fighting violently, at least you have a better chance because you can defend yourself? What's the best strategy? So Gene Sharp was one of these people who said, we have to look at this in a rational, kind of scientific way, and really kind of not irrationally, and look at what are the strategies, and we have to train ourselves and learn the different strategies of how to respond in nonviolent ways so that we know how to do it effectively. And we know what's behind it. We know the theory behind it. We know what the impact we're trying to have behind it, so that we're not just doing it blindly or passively. So Gandhi was one of those people who studied that, and he spent years training people, preparing people for the civil rights movement. This speech was given in 1958. So so my suggestion is, in Buddhist, boy, it's really ringing a lot. Let me put it on the ear. Apologize for that. Is that better? Not any better? Not ringing for me anymore. Is it ringing for you? Not ringing for you? Okay. There's a feedback going on. So, so what to do when someone wrongs you is really the question. When someone strikes you on your cheek, what do you do when someone wrongs you? And so my suggestion is, the Buddhist response is, you look them in the eye. And that metaphorically means that you kind of take your stand where you are, and you say, you can't do that. Maybe not in those words, but you engage the person, and you insist that the person engage you. If it's a one-time event and they walk away, maybe, you can't, there's not much you can do. They disappear. But if it's someone you have regular contact with, it makes a difference. If it's regular contact and you see someone regularly, then you have a certain power that you ask, you have to deal with me. Let's sit down, let's talk. But to do it, look people in the eye. There was a child-rearing technique I learned when my kids were young. Some of you might know this. The kids, the kids do things which they shouldn't. And so then you have to make an impression on them. And so one of the things that makes a big impression is when you have to talk to them, they need to talk to you, they understand what you're saying, something. Is you say, look at me. Can you look at me? While I'm talking, you have to look at me now. Or when you tell me this, can you look at me? And if they have to look at you, it's very hard for kids to kind of skirt around or to kind of avoid. They have to kind of take it seriously. It has a big impact. So what do you do when someone wrongs us? We look them in the eye. And what do we see when we look someone in the eye? So who are you is one question, but who's the other? And what are you able to see in the other person when you look at someone else? Do you see someone to be afraid of? Do you see someone to be angry at? Do you see someone who doesn't really count in your eyes, someone who's not really that important? Do you see someone who is someone who can do things for you, and so you want things from them? And that because you can want things from them, they have certain control over you. You're not willing to ruffle things too much. not willing to upset them, because if you upset them, they're going to leave, or they're not going to provide you with whatever it is you want them to have. What do you see when you see another person? Or if you look deep into the other person, do you see their capacity for love, for happiness, for peace? And to what degree are we tapping into and seeing the depths of people's souls, their hearts, their minds, and what they're capable and what's possible in there? And to what degree do we see the surface of people, our surface judgments and ideas? What does it take to see someone really deeply and well? So many times, I'm out in the world, and I see that the interactions I have with other people don't allow for a real seeing and meeting of people. It just kind of, they're not interested, they're busy. But every once in a while I'll meet someone, a store clerk or something, who seems quite open, relaxed, and they're willing to meet my eyes. And you can see the kind of meeting of kindred spirits, or meeting of something special happens, of two people. Something deeper happens. So what do you do when you get wronged? Do you put your ostrich heads in the sand? Do you bring out all your weapons? Do you run away? Do you argue to yourself, I don't really count? You know, I'm supposed to just do this Buddhist thing and just accept and be kind of, just, you know, work on myself. I would suggest that Buddhism emphasizes that you're supposed to be strong. That Buddhism is asking you to tap into your strength and take a stand and engage. Engage in a way that's nonviolent, but still engage. That's my idea. So, I hope that was okay. But I was so struck by that little conversation last Sunday that I've been kind of staying with it for the last week. We have about 10 minutes, so if someone would like to say something, this might be a good time. So all the way in the back, in the outer hall. Is there a mic? Yes, yeah. Phyllis, if you could. And this person's way out there.
I'm so excited about this topic this morning because I've been, for the past several months, studying how to transform evil. I've been doing a lot of reading about how to become a spiritual warrior and a lot of practice related to this. And, of course, evil as defined is an intention, an energy with the intention to cause harm or without regard for someone else's harm. And so what I've been discovering is exactly what you're saying, that empathy rather than angry response or fearful response is the answer. And to practice this, one of the first things I did was to go negotiate a new car at a dealership. And I was alarmed by how much evil was present in that negotiation. It was amazing to me that the tactics, the strategy that they have to cause the person to be in disequilibrium. And so I've been noticing in my daily life just the observation of when evil is present. And that is an amazing experience. When you see it, it gives you the option to respond successfully and spiritually to it.
Yeah. Well, great, thank you. It makes me curious about the definition of evil. Because the reason why I think it's an important issue is that one definition of evil has been that evil is when people, for no other reason than for their own pleasure, cause harm to others. But that's pretty rare. Most people who, like those, if someone's kind of manipulating you in a store in a way that's, in your language, is evil, they're not doing it just because they enjoy it, I hope, but rather they want something out of you. And so there's a lot of harm that people do to each other on the world where there's a strategy to get what they want. That's more than just, the pleasure of them. But if what they want, but once you kind of tune into that they want something, and you can see what they want, then you can kind of look behind that and more deeper, and perhaps begin having a relationship about something much more deeper than what's at the surface of it. when it's pure evil, it's very hard to think to have a conversation or to understand, because it just, it's gratuitous just for the sake of some kind of misunderstood pleasure. It's a powerful word to use, evil, the word evil. And so someone else.
Thank you for the talk. And the thought that I was having was to Burma, and having gotten to know one of the monks who survived the Saffron Revolution. I just wondered what your thoughts were about that. And
I don't have much thoughts. I'm not a deeply studied student of this whole topic, and or of Burma, what happened in Burma. And it's a very, we had a lot of hope when the Saffron Revolutions began there that it was going to somehow work, so when does it work and when doesn't it work? It strikes me that you need to give some thought to when it works and when it doesn't work. What are the conditions where someone, in Egypt, apparently the military at some point felt connected to their citizens. They felt, this is not people we want to attack. In Burma, the military has been attacking its people for decades. So there's a very, very different ethos going on there. Are they trained well enough in Burma? Egypt was kind of a well-developed country compared to Burma. Burma's pretty backward still. It's still, I don't know how backward, but I was there in the mid-80s, and I felt like I was stepping back into 1940s in Rangoon, but outside of that. I know there are people who've been trying to translate and smuggle in Gene Sharp's works into Burma so that people can be better prepared. But I don't have anything really intelligent to tell you. What were you hoping, I would say? Or, why are you asking the question about Burma?
To me it just seems so so terribly sad and awful, and I don't know, just kind of a contrast to Egypt. And just was thinking about it. I know someone personally who went through all that, and it just came to my mind.
Yeah, there's lots of sad things, and then I think that sometimes you have to be very patient for some of these things and keep thinking about it. It takes a lot of strategizing and thinking about, and a lot of courage. And sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes violence doesn't work. Violent uprisings sometimes haven't worked as well. And which camp do you put yourself in? I think really important aspects of, I think, what Buddhism, but also I think what Martin Luther King says here, is that he says, the fifth point, he has these different points about nonviolent resistance. The fifth point concerning nonviolent resistance is that it avoids not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of the spirit. The nonviolent resistor not only refuses to shoot one's opponent, but one also refuses to hate the opponent. At the center of the nonviolence stands the principle of love. So in the karma kind of foundation that Buddhism has, taking care of your own karma, taking care of your own heart, the purity or the beauty of your own heart is paramount. And so you want to avoid external violence, but you also want to avoid the ways in which we are violent within. And so we're the custodian of our capacity not to hate, not to be greedy, not to be afraid. And so that's one of the contributions I feel Buddhism has to make, to this, you know, how we hopefully can live in a world in an effective, powerful way, is that Buddhist meditation, Buddhist practice, is a powerful practice, powerful teachings for how to look into our own hearts and minds and understand how to keep it from being violent in there, keep it from being succumbing to anger or hate, frustration, fear, all of those other kinds of forces. And so it's not just a matter of what we do externally, it's also a matter of what we do internally. And I think one of the beautiful aspects of this, of you know, of the Saffron Revolution, was the degree to which the monks who stood up were not willing to give in to hate. They might have lost the external struggle. I hope they didn't lose the internal one. So one more.
Hi, I think you said something to the effect of each uprising has very specific circumstances, and so it requires almost like intuitive responses often in the moment, and this man wanted to study and make more of a scientific practice. And I think that we have the same situation. My mic's not working. Is this working? We have the same situations at work often, in places, people with conflict sometimes, maybe a superior who you feel is abusive towards you. And the immediate response for me can be really knee-jerk. And if I am more mindful of how I want to be inside here, I think it's easier for me to confront in a healthy way, or in a kind way, or a loving way, and then it's easier to be intuitive. But I think it takes a great deal of mindfulness prior to finding solutions.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. That's why you should practice mindfulness. I heard it's a good idea.
I hadn't thought of that. Thanks.
And, you know, if you wait to be mindful, if you wait to practice mindfulness for when there's a crisis, it might be too late. But if you develop these skills, mindfulness and many other things, a lot of the big challenges that people have in life are best dealt with if we're well prepared. And so, practicing regularly prepares us for the crises in life when they come along. If we have to engage in difficult problems at work that involve very intense conversations, maybe it's good to prepare by taking a class in nonviolent communication, or because just rely on whatever innate ability you have to converse, you know, might not be enough. You might need to be trained in how to speak in a way that's much more effective and careful, and so nonviolent communication can be a very effective way. If you want to be involved in nonviolent struggle against the government, maybe you should do nonviolent training. You know, I kind of grew up in Norway, and Norway has a high percentage of, back when I was there, of people who were conscientious objectors to serving in the military. And Norway has mandatory military service for all males. And they're about, I don't know, 18, 19, 20 or so. They go spend a year in the military. And it's relatively easy to get conscientious, back then, when I was there, conscientious objector kind of status. But if you were, you didn't have to serve in the military. But what you had to do then was serve 2 years doing some kind of civil work. Like you'd work in a hospital for 2 years and help in the hospital. And you had to do something for the society. You couldn't just get off scot-free. You had to contribute back. And so, but then it was 2 years instead of 1 year. And but some of the conscientious objectors didn't like this option, because they said, we also want to defend our country, and they felt the presence of Russia not far away, and they felt, you know, Norway had been invaded by the Germans in World War II, and so the idea that Norway was vulnerable was quite active for some people, and they didn't want to just go be orderly in a hospital. They wanted to be able to defend the country as well. And what they were lobbying for was they wanted a nonviolent resistance boot camp. They wanted to be trained because they felt it was a very effective, and they wanted to be trained in that, so they were ready as well to be able to resist the next invasion. So to be prepared. So please prepare yourself. And my trust is that the basic practice of Buddhism is a tremendous preparation for learning to deal with conflict. And my hope is that Buddhist practitioners are skilled and wise and willing to be present for conflict. That we are not conflict-averse of culture, but we don't create conflict, but we're willing to be present for it. So, good luck.